This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast. I am your host, as always, Jesse Collings. No guests today. It's just me. So if you ever wanted to listen to the Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast and you just wanted to hear me talk, if you're like, man, I love that Jesse Collings, but that guest he has, I hate that person and I never want to hear them talk. Or you just fast forward through each podcast when you hear the guest talking just to get back to me. That's what you want out of this podcast. This is the show for you because there is no guest. It's just me. I've got six topics written down. And that's really the reason why I don't have a guest was largely because I didn't have like a really strong topic to bring on a guest and talk about in like a deep dive kind of way, like the most of the episodes of this podcast are based around. Instead, I had just kind of six topics that I've been thinking about for a while. Some of them are more current than others, but I wanted to get through them and I wanted to kind of give my thoughts on each of them, and I hope our listeners are interested in hearing them. So will I be able to produce the show and do compelling audio just by myself? Will I do a whole show without turning away from the microphone so you can't hear some of my words? That's something that I noticed that I do a lot. We'll see. So let's get started. I'm going to start with Death Before Dishonor. That was the Ring of Honor show that took place this past Friday. I'm recording this on the afternoon of Monday, July 29th. But I saw Death Before Dishonor over the weekend, and one of the things I wanted to talk about was kind of where Ring of Honor is in the overall wrestling landscape. Now that we've kind of seen how invested Tony Khan is in it, and kind of what kind of level of talent they're putting on the Ring of Honor shows for the most part. Ever since Tony bought Ring of Honor, I think there's been a general sense of disappointment that it hasn't been promoted particularly well, that it hasn't had a ton of creative focus. It hasn't felt important or relevant at all. And that's definitely true. But part of me wonders, and as I was watching this show, and really I was thinking about this like for the last month or so as we were kind of building up to Death Before Dishonor. And that was, shouldn't we just view Ring of Honor as essentially an independent wrestling promotion that puts on a big show once every few months that you pay attention to? Because not only is that seemed to be the best way currently to consume Ring of Honor is to maybe skip the weekly television show and just pay attention to the pay-per-view events. But also that's kind of like historically what Ring of Honor is, right? Like Ring of Honor, while they have had weekly television for probably over 10 years now, it's never like that weekly television show was always important. You always had to watch Ring of Honor on HDNet or Ring of Honor on your local Sinclair station. I feel like most people watched Ring of Honor the way they watch Ring of Honor now, which is paying attention when there's a big show. I know people I think are disappointed that Ring of Honor hasn't found like a television station home or maybe a streaming television home for the weekly show. That's obviously something Tony has talked about a lot, and I still believe that's probably one of his goals with the promotion is to get its TV time somewhere. But to me, Ring of Honor is now not that, if you really think about it, it's not that different than what it was before Tony bought it. The reason I think Ring of Honor feels less relevant now is because of AEW's entire existence, that Ring of Honor had a place in the wrestling universe as the largest American wrestling promotion that really cared about the in-ring product and wasn't beholden to a lot of WWE tropes and WWE style of wrestling presentation. And that was largely, they had their spot in the market corrected by AEW coming into existence and taking a lot of their talent and presenting essentially a much larger budgeted Ring of Honor like product to a wider audience. So Ring of Honor is never going to get back into its place of prominence the way it was in like 2016, 2017, because that's just an era of wrestling that's long in the past. That was 8 years ago. What we see have now is a product that has a lot of talent, that is well-funded, and it does, you know, against conventional wisdom or against what a lot of people talk about, it does have a creative direction. We're not seeing really that unfold on AEW television like maybe we did like a year ago or 2 years ago, but if you watch this show, it's not necessarily just a bunch of random matches slapped together like a PWG show is. There were feuds, there were, you know, blow-offs, there was stuff that storylines that were continued through this show. To me, this is, it was a very good show, but it also was a show of like a promotion that actually felt alive and vibrant. And yes, there are stars that are on both AEW and Ring of Honor, and maybe they should be split off. So Ring of Honor has its own select group of stars that make it feel independent of AEW. But even in Ring of Honor's glory days, like we want to go back to the 2016-2017 era, Ring of Honor's top stars were on New Japan Pro Wrestling. They were wrestling in for the UK indies. They were wrestling on indies around the country. It wasn't like Ring of Honor always had like this its own separate roster. Its top stars have always been available and present in a lot of times larger promotions. So again, I feel like there's kind of this misconception about Ring of Honor that it has just completely fallen apart. It's super uninteresting. It's super boring. It's not given any creative focus. It's just this fifth rate wrestling promotion, and that's radically different than what it was before. And I don't really think that's the case. When I watched the show, I thought if you just think about AEW's existence and kind of where how much time and focus that takes away from Ring of Honor in terms of wrestling fan interest. All of the old Ring of Honor fans are now watching AEW week to week for the most part. I just don't get the sense that Ring of Honor is like radically different than where it was before. The difference is that AEW is around, and that's a much more prominent promotion. There are obviously, I think, ways to improve Ring of Honor. It's not a perfect promotion. Obviously, I think, I don't even dispute that Tony has done like a bad job making it seem exciting. But when I watched the show and when I watched this show, I was like, I find it hard for people to really, you know, to get that bent out of shape about what Ring of Honor has become, because I saw a crowd that was hot and into the action. I saw a bunch of wrestlers that the crowd was into. I saw excellent, you know, commentary with Patrice, with Caprice Coleman and Ian Riccaboni. I always love hearing those guys. I saw a show in a promotion that feels like it would be probably the biggest indie in the country if it was still considered an indie and it wasn't owned by a billionaire connected with another major wrestling company. If we just go back and think about, like, compare Ring of Honor to any other indie in the United States, and I think it comes across favorably. Now, maybe that's still a disappointment to what we thought Ring of Honor could be when Tony first bought it. But to me, it's still, it's far better than pretty much any other indie in the United States. I mean, I don't know which else you would compare it to. Maybe Wrestling Revolver or Deadlock Pro. Those ones seem to have decent production value at least and get some big names. But if you just looked at this, it's like, this is an indie, which is what Ring of Honor historically is, right? It's an independent wrestling company. This is a promotion that feels a lot of the same. And it did do some things on the show that I think there have been some criticisms about AEW not doing. So if you're looking at like what is different about this show than the AEW product? This, why would someone watch Ring of Honor instead of watching AEW? I would say that for starters, this Ring of Honor probably has the most fleshed out women's division in all of American pro wrestling at this point. This was a show that had three women's matches on it. I thought all three of them were good. I know some people had mixed feelings about the Red Velvet versus Billy Starks match. I thought that was a perfectly acceptable match. The Layla Hirsch Diamante match obviously was super entertaining as kind of the wild brawl plunder match that they had on the show. And then the semi-main event, you know, Athena versus Queen Aminata. I mean, Athena has had the RH Women's World Championship for almost 600 days. And really her and Mark Briscoe are the heart and soul of this promotion. And they've been the champions for quite a while now. And so I think there's a lot of focus in the women's division. I thought there was a lot of focus in the tag team division. Something that I think AEW has certainly gone away from is really promoting the various different tag teams. Especially if you watch the pre-show, there's just a lot of good tag team wrestling on this show. And there's a lot of focus on the tag team division, which again, I think is something that AEW has kind of been lacking. And just like, I like seeing a guy like Lee Moriarty, who is kind of lost in the shuffle as just a guy on the AEW roster, be able to come onto ROH and he gets to have a 20-minute title match, which is something he'd probably never get to have in AEW proper. He's getting a chance to kind of flex his muscles and really perform in Ring of Honor. So all of that I would consider to be benefits of having Ring of Honor around. So I don't disagree with necessarily a lot of the criticisms and frustrations that some fans have with Ring of Honor, but I think the narrative that it's like this failed brand that Tony should just fold up because it's super unsuccessful, I think that's totally wrong. I think that there's a lot of benefits to having it around. I think it's ultimately not that different than what it would be like if Tony didn't own it. I think it certainly has more talent because Tony's able to lean on the AEW roster. And obviously everyone knows they're going to get paid when they get in a Ring of Honor date. And I think it is still providing some value. Again, you don't have to watch the weekly television. The weekly television product is ultimately kind of unnecessary unless you're really, really into the storylines. But that was kind of always been the case historically in Ring of Honor. It's never been a week-to-week tune-in-and-watch television product. It's never been that in its 23 years of existence. So should it be with, you know, the additional funding and you know, production value that being owned by Tony Khan comes with it? Yeah, you could make the case, but it should be. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's particularly worse off not being like that. So those are my thoughts on Ring of Honor. I thought Death Before Dishonor was a really good show. I had five matches I wrote down in my notebook for, which is pretty close to the most of on any show I've watched this year. So that would put it in the match of the show of the year contender slot. I don't think it had anything that I would consider like a match of the year level contender. But I thought every single thing on the show was really good, or at least passable. There are some things that weren't very good, but I had a lot of fun watching the show. I loved the Dustin Rhodes and Von Erichs versus Dark Order match. That's objectively probably not that good of a match. But I thought it was worked really well, building up towards the final, you know, few minutes, which I thought were handled amazingly well. The Von Erichs and Dustin going over in Texas is an easy pop. And it was a really positive vibes match, which again helped make the promotion feel alive and important. Right, you have the Von Erichs and Dustin Rhodes teaming up in Texas, and they win, you know, the ROH World Six-Man titles, which aren't really that important titles, but the crowd was into it. The crowd popped big for the finish. Everyone was celebrating, you know, when they won, and those are the kind of things that make a promotion feel alive and vibrant and important, and like what you're watching is something, a valuable way to spend your time. And I think that's ultimately what Ring of Honor needs to have going forward. So that is where I stand on Ring of Honor. I'm going to switch gears now and talk about the G1. I am not all the way caught up on the G1. I have not watched the most recent show, which would be Night 7. But I am otherwise relatively caught up to the show. I'm just going to kind of run through my thoughts on... I'm going to try to do this really fast. We'll see how fast I can actually do this while also making it somewhat compelling. But I'm just going to run through every single person in the G1 so far. Again, I haven't seen every single match because I have not watched Night 7. But other than that, I have seen pretty much every match. There's a couple that I've skipped. They're mostly evil matches. But I have seen most of the tournament so far. So we'll start with Oleg Bolton. Bolton Oleg. I'm still not 100% sure what the right way is to call him. I'm a big fan of him. I thought when he came out for his first match in the tournament, wearing the Kazakh colored, blue, baby blue, yellow tights and boots, I was like, all right, I'm so happy to see him out of the Young Lion Black. He's now got his color change. He's ready to become a real wrestler in this company, not just a young boy, which was made apparent when he beat Hiroshi Tanahashi to help qualify for the G1. But I have thought he's done a really good job. I know he's green. I know that he's not going to go out there and have like these five-star matches in the G1, but I find him to be really entertaining. He's just got he's got a different vibe than anyone else in the tournament. Because he's got that, he's like Brock Lesnar. He's like this huge guy with this really accomplished amateur background, and he's athletic and he tosses people around. And those are guys that I personally am always going to be excited to see when they wrestle. There was, I believe, his second match of this tournament was against Hanare. And just when the bell rung for that, and those two guys were just looking at each other across the ring, I was like, I got this real sense of satisfaction where I was like, this is proper, New Japan Pro Wrestling. Just these two believable tough guys are going to just punch each other and beat on each other for like 10 minutes, which is what they did. It wasn't like a five-star match. It wasn't like a really particularly notably great match by any stretch of the imagination, but it was fun. And it was just the proper vibes in a promotion that used to be like the most reliable in-ring product in the world. And over the last 5 years or so, has just been kind of weighed down by different philosophical outlooks in terms of certain talent, some of whom we're going to get into later. But seeing Oleg Bolton and Hanare, just like, these are two proper guys that kind of get what I want out of the New Japan Pro Wrestling product, which is just straight up guys beating each other, which is really what I think the promotion is largely about. So good on Oleg Bolton, Bolton Oleg, however you want to pronounce his name. El Phantasmo. I don't have a ton to say about El Phantasmo. I know people said he was been like one of the down parts of this tournament. I don't know. I wouldn't go as that far. I definitely think that a few years ago there was this potential for ELP where he was seen as a potentially like top babyface guy because he did have charisma. It seemed like he was getting over when he first kind of broke into the G1. It was like, this guy, El Phantasmo, he could be like, an upper mid-card level guy, babyface guy. And I think that's probably not going to happen for him. He's getting older. He never quite hit that level necessary. He's probably destined for like a tag team role, which is basically what he's in now. Frankly, him getting into the G1 over people like Ishii, Tanahashi, or Yoshihashi, or Taichi, like that's probably a pretty big accomplishment for him at this point. I don't think he's been terrible in the tournament or anything, but he's someone that would be like on the cut list if you're just looking at next year and the year after that, if you want to incorporate some more young guys or get some new blood in there. I just don't see the ceiling. I think the ceiling that he maybe flashed that he had a few years ago was gone. Jeff Cobb, super reliable. I've said this before and I've been proven wrong because he has gotten there, but I get the sense with Jeff Cobb that he has one gear. He's a reliable wrestler. He never goes out there and stinks out the joint. He obviously can do some cool spots with his strength, and he's over to a certain degree, but his ability to have like a truly outstanding match just isn't there for me. The way he is for people, I think he's like a solid 3.25 star worker. I just don't see him really getting past that all that frequently. And so, and because he's older, and because I feel like that's his ceiling, he's got kind of he's a limited performer for me in terms of the G1. Like, he's never, like, if Jeff Cobb was in the main event of one of these nights, I'm not like super hyped up for that match, because I'm like, oh, Jeff Cobb's in the main event, and that's a weaker night for the G1. And it's not because he's bad, it's just because I don't think he can really get to that next level to a reliable degree. Someone that can get to the next level, or has at least flashed it, is Yuya Uemura. I think there's been some discussion about him kind of being the forgotten guy in kind of New Japan's young lion or new era, revolution. People talk about Yota Tsuji, people talk about Shota Umino. People used to talk about Ren Narita. I don't think they really do that much anymore. But even if you look at like underneath, talk about someone like Oleg Bolton or Oiwa or someone like that. Like, it's Uemura, just kind of another guy. He's hanging out there. He's just kind of, he didn't really flash a ton when he was Young Lion, so it was kind of hard to figure out exactly what he's doing. He's just five guys and all that stuff like that. It's just, but I think this has been a real coming out party for him. He obviously had that excellent match with Takeshita, where he went over. He's getting a good run so far in the G1. He won his first three matches. So I'm a fan of Uemura. I think he has potential to eventually get there as a top guy in New Japan. I feel the same way kind of like about Umino. I think Umino's been pushed a lot harder. And to that degree, you could say Umino's kind of been unconvincing. So that leaves the door open for someone like Yuya to come in and be presented and get over to a higher degree and kind of leapfrog Umino in terms of the trajectory of where these guys are. But he's been really impressive. I think he's got good babyface fire. I think that he maybe has a little bit more natural charisma than Umino, and can kind of tap into that more easily than Umino, who kind of needs to be pushed and prodded in the very specific direction to get the most out of him. But a very good tournament so far for Yuya. I'm happy that not only has he did he make the tournament, not only has he had good matches, but he's also, gotten wins and things like that. Konosuke Takeshita. Obviously, I don't really have a ton to say about Takeshita, because I think everyone knows that I rate him really highly. And I've been just thinking, like, is Takeshita, this year at least, is he the best Japanese wrestler in the world? I think he's definitely, I mean, he's in the elite conversation. I don't know who else would be in it. I mean, you could say Okada still. I don't think the results are there this year from Okada. I don't think that there's anyone in New Japan, maybe Shingo, who's on his level as an in-ring guy. So it'd probably be Shingo and Takeshita. And then, you could say Kiyomiya. You could say like Kento Miyahara. Again, Miyahara kind of like Okada. I don't think the results are really there, although the reputation and track record of being excellent is obviously still there. But Takeshita might be the best Japanese wrestler in the world. And he's would be on the short list for very best wrestlers in the world. Anyway, and he's been outstanding in this tournament. He's probably been the best performer in the tournament overall, just night in, night out, hasn't had a bad match yet. So obviously a great performance by Takeshita. Hanare is a guy who's I kind of probably like more than most people. I already kind of touched on him when I talked about Oleg Bolton, but just Hanare has the convincing badass aura where I look at this guy and I'm like, this guy's a tough guy. This guy is going to kick some ass in this tournament. And that's exactly what he's going to do. Outside of his matches with Shingo, he hasn't really been pushed outside of the G1. I would like to see a little bit more Hanare focus as maybe a bigger role in New Japan overall. But he's to me a very good and convincing performer that's done really well standing out in the G1 year after year. I kind of expect him to be one of those guys that's, you know, has a ton of really good G1s, kind of like Haruki Goto ended up being. Like Goto, you know, he won the G1 before, but Goto was always just like one of those guys. It's like Goto comes in and he has like 6 4-star matches over the course of the G1. I feel like Hanare can be at that level. David Finlay. Finlay, you know, he's taken a lot of shit. I think deservedly so. He hasn't knocked out of the park, kind of as the leader of the Bullet Club War Dogs. And, you know, if you look at the history of leaders of the Bullet Club, you know, going back to Prince Devitt and then AJ and then Kenny Omega and then Jay White. And it's like David Finlay is obviously not close to the talent level of those other guys. And it kind of is almost like a symbolic of kind of New Japan's talent loss over the last few years, where now David Finlay is like a top foreigner when you compare it to who the top foreigners were in the past. That being said, he's been very good in this tournament, I think. His match against Ren Narita wasn't particularly good, but that's not David Finlay's fault. I thought he has done a really good job so far in this tournament, having good matches, having exciting matches. And there's some question marks in this tournament. I'll point to Narita again, but also guys like Jake Lee. We'll talk about Naito later. Like, there's been some guys where it's been like, ooh, it's, you know, Evil, of course, or Sonata. It's like, ooh, it's tough to have, you know, it's, there's not a ton of super duper reliable guys in the G1 compared to previous years. But Finlay is a guy who I think has stepped up and has gone out there and had really solid high level matches, which they needed someone like him to outperform expectations for this tournament to really hit on all cylinders. And I think he's done his job. He's held up his end of the bargain in regards to that. Ren Narita, get him out of the way. I don't like him. I think that he has really struggled to find his identity ever since graduating him from young boy status. I think the whole Son of Strong style and the Shibata cosplay was a huge flop. So I understand why they had to pivot to him. I don't need another House of Torture-esque constant interfering and cheating heel. Against that, when we talk about Evil, because that's a whole other can of worms. But just, these are people that we don't need to have in New Japan, and these are people that I don't need to see in the tournament at all. I think his, and I just don't see a ceiling for him, really. I think he's a flop, and probably, I mean, he'll probably be in New Japan for a long time. I don't think he's in danger of being signed by anybody else, for the reasons that I just don't think he has a high ceiling at all at this point. He needs to change characters again, I guess. This will be number three for him. Or he'll just be like a shitty interference laden heel, which the company doesn't need. But I guess he could be in that role for like the next 10 years, since that seems to be how Gato books these days. Haruki Goto, the G in G1 stands for Goto. Goto, of course, is a super reliable performer. I do actually think there's an interesting story to be told here, and they've kind of hit it on commentary a little bit, that Goto is the last really of his kind of class of New Japan wrestlers that's in this tournament. You know, Tanahashi's not in this tournament. Shinsuke Nakamura is not in this tournament. Kazuchika Okada, no. Ishii didn't make it. Yoshihashi's not in this tournament. So I guess Naito, you could say, is somewhat similar to him in age. But really, this is a young man's tournament now. And Goto's kind of like the last guy standing, and he would be considered maybe like the weakest star of those groups, except Yoshihashi. But I think there's some charm in like Goto being the last guy. You know, I think he's 44 years old, 45 years old, and being kind of like the last person standing from that era and trying to represent all of that glorious period of New Japan Pro Wrestling in his matches. And I could take him in the G until he really breaks down. And compared to all those other guys, with the exception of Okada, Goto really seems pretty close to his peak still, physically. I'll take him in the G1 every year for as long as I'll have him, because he always goes out there and delivers. Yota Tsuji, he's only got 2 points so far. I'm worried about, I think he's great. I think he's my favorite out of all of the young guys that they're trying to push upwards, but they got to push him more. He's only got 2 points. Maybe he's going to come back, and obviously it's hard to rule anyone out because of the two people advancing to the semifinals and things like that. So he's got a chance to still come back, but he is someone that I really think feel like they need to push. He has the in-ring work, he has the charisma. There's a story to tell between him and Naito. He probably, if I was booking the G1, I would probably book him to win. But it just like last year when he didn't win the young guys group in the G1 because they had to put Hikuleo over for some reason. There's been some frustration with not pushing him hard enough, and I get worried that he's going to get stagnant and not ultimately achieve what he should be able to achieve in New Japan, which in I think should be like a long IWGP reign and really a reset of the entire promotion because he's the kind of guy that I think you build around. So that was everyone in the B block. We're going to switch over to the A block now. Again, I have not seen Night 7, which was A block matches. So I'm one match behind on these guys. I would be surprised if anything dramatically changes on these nights. But we'll start with Callum Newman, along with Bolton Ole, kind of like the young guy that qualified for this tournament. He's so young that it's hard to really say anything definitive about him. I think he's been really good given his experience level. He's still got a ways to go in a lot of different aspects of pro wrestling, but when you're talking about someone who's only 21 years old and already wrestling in a G1, I think that's pretty special. And I think that barring like just an absolutely catastrophically bad run here, anything that coming out of this G1 is positive, and I think he's already had some solid performances. And that match against Shingo, I really liked the finish against Shingo, where he popped out of the DDT and then immediately hit the Ass Cutter to win the match. I know some people maybe don't like that level I wouldn't even call it not selling because, in my opinion, in my mind, like Newman didn't take the DDT. He blocked it and then immediately hit his finisher and won. So to me, it's a logical finish, but some people have a hard time grasping that, I guess. But he's been a solid performer. And again, he's so young that we're still talking about, someone who's probably a decade away from their true prime in pro wrestling. So definitely worth someone invest, you know, definitely worth investing in him at this point in time if you're in New Japan. And with AEW lurking, it's kind of like you got to invest in these guys earlier because they're going to get snapped up earlier. You're not going to, your chances are you're probably not going to have Callum Newman for 10 years. If Callum Newman continues to progress at the rate he has already in his career, he's probably going to be signed by AEW in the next several years. So if you're really interested in Callum Newman, you want to get the most out of him while you have him, because I think re-signing him might be difficult, especially when you consider his relationship with Will Ospreay. And Ospreay going into AEW. I think that's just the reality, especially with these foreign wrestlers coming into New Japan, that you got to compete with, a savvy competitor that has a lot more money and is, get on in American television. So it's going to be hard for New Japan to win those negotiating battles, especially if you're a young guy like Cal Newman, who feels like they're on the path to superstardom. I guess I'll talk about Evil now. Tanahashi, mentions in his comments, and I don't know how much of them are shoot comments, how much of them are part of, kayfabe, because he's the real life president of New Japan. But he talks about like cleaning up New Japan Pro Wrestling, kind of like, we want to have, less interference, less this and that. And people talk about those comments like that Tanahashi makes, like wrestling is real. Like they talk about like, oh, there's less interference. He's trying to get it cleaned up a little bit. So you're seeing less of the interference. And to me, it's like, if you want to have less interference, you just say we're going to have no interference in our matches. You book the show. So if, Dick Togo, and Evil and Gato, whoever else is calling the shots, it's like, man, we gotta have these numerous interference finishes. You say, no, we don't do that because we don't do interference finishes anymore. But for some reason, we still have all of these people from House of Torture running in night after night, and it's so antithetical to what I think of when I think of New Japan Pro Wrestling. And it's like just a plague. And every Evo match, I've seen about half of them so far in the G1, and I find myself skipping a lot of them because I'm just like, I just can't, they're all the same. I know that the crowd kind of gets into it. And I know in this match with Naito, like the crowd was into seeing Bushi come out and chase them off and Naito to pull off the comeback and things like that, although Evo ultimately won the match. But to me, it's like, I don't need to see this anymore. Evil's sitting at 10 points right now, so I feel like he's probably going to make the semifinals, which is going to be awful because that just makes me less interested in one of the semifinal matches. God forbid he makes the finals, and God forbid he actually wins the whole thing, which I think would set this promotion back a couple years. But I just don't need to see this anymore in New Japan. It's been the case for years, and I'm going to sound like a broken record because I keep saying it. Great Okan. I think that Okan has had a good tournament. I think he is, he's someone that I've flip-flopped on a number of times. I really was excited about him as a young boy. Didn't really like the Okan gimmick when he was in England. When he came back, I was like, this is kind of interesting. Then he was really boring. Then he was really good and started to kind of flash, the amateur background and things like that. Then he kind of became just like a guy on the New Japan roster. And, when he was first was a young boy, I was like, this guy is a potential world champion material because look at how big he is. And he's got this great amateur background. He's tossing people around. This is great. And I think the gimmick and maybe some other things have kind of caused him to not reach that potential. But I do think he's evolved into a pretty solid G1 performer. Similar to Hanare, he's probably never going to be a world champion, but he goes out there and, he's ditched the really obnoxious, like old school, gold tights that I always thought looked ridiculous. And he's going with more of like a fight short look. And he comes across as a convincing, badass, which is a huge part of being a pro wrestler. And he's been solid in this tournament. I would put him probably in the middle of the pack, which is good because even though there's some low points in this G1 field, it is still a field of, for the most part, extremely good wrestlers. So if you're like the eighth best wrestler in a G1, that still means you're pretty damn good. Jake Lee, the smart bastard. It's kind of interesting because, like, I guess when they brought in Jake Lee, the idea was that, like, oh, Jake Lee is going to get another push. He's now in New Japan. He keeps failing upward. And that's true. Getting to New Japan is, a bigger deal for him than, wrestling in All Japan or wrestling in Noah. But he hasn't really been protected at all in this tournament. He lost to Okan on night seven. He's got 2 points. He lost to Zack Sabre Jr. He lost to Tetsuya Naito. He did beat Sonata quickly. And so that was kind of the whole, like, oh, here comes the big Jake Lee push, only for to have him lose 3 straight matches. And granted, losing to Naito, that's, Naito's a world champion. He's not going to lose that many matches in this tournament. Losing to, Zack Sabre Jr., who a lot of people feel like is the favorite to win the tournament. Okay, that's okay. But he just lost Okan. So he's sitting there at 2 points. About halfway through the tournament. So I don't see like the giant Jake Lee push coming. And thank God for that. I he's Jake Lee. I don't think he's terrible, but he's just not an exciting pro wrestler is the best way to say it. And when you see someone who's not an exciting pro wrestler get chance after chance after chance, when other guys who seem to have like a lot of potential just can never quite break through, it becomes really frustrating. And those guys who get all those chances kind of become the target of a lot of fan displeasure. But like, would this tournament be better if Tomohiro Ishii was in it and not Jake Lee? Absolutely. So it is what it is. I don't see Jake Lee getting this giant push. I mean, I guess he could challenge the world title at some point and that'll be like a boring match, but he seems like he's just going to be like a mid-carder who was going to float around, maybe like the never title scene. And that's probably his ceiling in New Japan as it currently stands. I don't see him like getting this giant rocket strap to the moon push, which was, certainly looked like a possibility when he wiped the floor with Sonata really early in this tournament. just blast through these last few guys. Shota Umino, I kind of talked about him already when I was talking about how he compared to Uemura. You know, I'm probably higher on Shota than most people. I think he does have a certain level of charisma that can get him over the hump, but he kind of just needs to be pushed in the right way. I thought his match with Gabe Kidd was quite good. You know, but he's been a guy, he can have some pretty disappointing matches in big spots. He can also have some really good matches in good spots, in big spots. I don't think he's shown the level of consistency that you want to see out of a potential top guy, but I do think it's there somewhere. It's just harder to get that out of him than it is for other wrestlers. Zack Sabre Jr., I think, has a case for being the best wrestler of this year in terms of just pure in-ring work. He's been great in the tournament. He's obviously done a great job getting his style of wrestling over. And I always love seeing him wrestle in these tournaments. And the reason why is because he can win in so many different ways. He wins with all these different roll-ups. He wins with all these different types of submission moves. You never know when the match is going to end. Anytime he gets his hands on somebody, it feels like the match is in danger of ending. There's just no one else in wrestling really like that who has earned that reputation because of how different, how many different ways he can win a match. His matches feel different than everyone else's. They're totally unique. And he's just super excellent at his style. If he wins the whole tournament, I mean, you're going to main event the Tokyo Dome with Zack Sabre Jr. It still seems kind of like a stretch. There's maybe a better use of that spot than giving it to someone like Zach, who maybe has a ceiling, but I can't knock the work that Zach has done because he's truly an outstanding pro wrestler. And we'll talk about him during Hall of Fame season. I don't think he's going to be on the ballot this year, but he's the best I've ever seen at wrestling this certain style. And he's been one of the best in-ring wrestlers in the world for the last 10 years. And so I think that deserves some level of consideration. Last four guys, Gabe Kidd. I am high on Gabe Kidd. He just has a level of obnoxiousness to him that he needs to tone down. And I don't think it's like that complicated. Like there's this idea where it's like, oh, he's just got to toe the line of being like a real heel and just going over the line and being a little too annoying. So fans don't, you know, want to watch him work. And I don't feel like there's like a really like, you know, hard to see line that it's hard to kind of for him to kind of keep himself from stepping over. I just don't want you like leaving the ring in the middle of a match to go give someone at ringside a random brain buster because you're you want to show that you're an asshole. Okay. That is stuff that you can just easily get rid of. It's not like a fine line, that kind of stuff. When you're just totally taking me out of a match because you're trying to do this cheap heat spot, that's really stupid. I don't really care about him like swearing in the ring or talking really loud into the mic or thing into the ringside mic area and things like that. That stuff doesn't bother me. It's just, it's the other like more obnoxious, like, can we focus on this being a proper pro wrestling match and not like random, like edgy bullshit? That'd be great. But he's obviously, I think, a really talented wrestler. He has that level of, you know, physicality to him that I think like someone like David Finlay doesn't have. And I think that's what gives him such a high ceiling is because he does come across like a convincing ass kicker that you're going to have to, who's a bully, that you're going to have to really punch in the face over and over again to win and to beat. So he's done a good job in the G1 second year in a row. He's kind of, last year he actually kind of sucked in the G1. I don't know why I said it, second year in a row. But I think he's having a good year overall. Like I think this is easily the best year of his career and he's shown a lot of promise in that regard. Shingo Takagi, I don't think I've spent too long on Shingo. You know, one of the best wrestlers in the world. Like I said, when I was talking about Takeshita, I think him and Takeshita are the two best wrestlers probably in the entire company, or in this tournament at least. Hits him, Takeshita, and Zach, I think, are pretty definitively the three best wrestlers in this G1. And Shingo hasn't disappointed, and he never does because he's Shingo Takagi, and he's maybe the most consistent wrestler in the history of the world. The last two, Sonata, seems like kind of a fall from grace for Sonata, given he was just washed by Jake Lee, you know, 1 year after being IWGP World Heavyweight Champion. You know, I think they tried with Sonata. They gave him a title reign. They wanted to see what he would do as world champion. Didn't really take, and he's kind of back in his old slot, which is a mid-card guy, which is fine. I do think, In like a healthier wrestling environment, Sonata would maybe go somewhere else where he would, because it's kind of hard to get pushed after you got pushed really hard, and people saw how you hit your ceiling, and then you're kind of on this downward trajectory after you hit your ceiling. It's kind of hard to still be in a promotion like that. But he's fine, I guess. I mean, I'm never really that excited to see a Sonata match. Occasionally, he pulls out some brilliance because he is capable of being really good at certain times, but he's just not consistent enough. And there's a dryness to his work and his personality that, really handicaps, how good he can be most nights. And lastly, the champion, Tetsuya Naito. Naito, to me, he's gone from being a guy who isn't, a guy who wasn't as good as he was at his peak, but still a very good professional wrestler, to being someone who is a real liability as a wrestler. He's had some awful matches. His offense looks like shit. He can't hit the destino. He's getting lost in the ring. They're loudly calling spots in the ring. It's not like Tanahashi. Like, Tanahashi went to this decline that took kind of years and years, where he was among the best wrestlers in the world for a long time, and then he was like a guy with like a hard 4 and a quarter a star ceiling, where he could have really good matches like he did during the G1, but he wasn't gonna, win any match of the years anymore. And then like he kind of gradually fell down the ladder until now he's just kind of like this guy whose body is cooked and mostly just does tag matches and didn't even make the G1 this year. Naito feels like as recently as like earlier this year, he was still moving pretty well at a high level. And just for whatever reason, over the last few months, he just seems to have fallen off a cliff. And his match against Jake Lee was one of the worst matches I've seen in a big spot, in a major promotion in a while. I'm sure there's probably other worse ones, but just it was a complete mess, fell apart. Offense and everything looked super sloppy. He just it's sad to see, but he's a real liability out there. And I know some people are annoyed that this keeps getting brought up with him, but look, he's the most popular wrestler in the company. He's the world champion. He's closing most of these shows that he's on. It matters that that guy is really under delivering in the ring. And he had, his match against Shingo was good. His match against Zach was good, but it wasn't good because he was with Night. They were with Naito. He was there because he was with two excellent wrestlers that could kind of, the Zach match was more to what Naito can do because it's not as explosive as the Shingo's match. It's, more grappling based, which, Naito's lack of knees aren't as big of a factor. But the Shingo match was like Shingo, ping-ponging around and trying to make everything look good. And Naito, really struggling to keep up. And then, of course, the Jake Lee match was a disaster. But those are my thoughts on the G1. We'll see if we'll see, what happens in the second half of the tournament as we get rolling. We're starting to see kind of take shape. We're seeing some guys jump out to leads, like you talked about, like Evil and Zack Sabre Jr. And some guys kind of falling behind. Maybe, we'll see if Yota Tsuji turns it around. We'll see if, Evil collapses. We'll see if Jake Lee maybe gets that giant push and starts winning a bunch of matches again. So we'll check. We might check in at the end. I might do a show towards the end of the G1 that's maybe more thorough recap of where we are with New Japan after the G1. Might be something I've talked about with some other people doing. So we'll see with that. But that's enough for the G1 now. I'm going to move on. We're going to shift gears to World Wrestling Entertainment. So with WWE, I kind of have two thoughts. The first thought is, how bad is Solo Sikoa? So Solo is getting this major, major match at SummerSlam. He is most likely going to main event a stadium show, which should really mean a lot. They run more stadium shows now, but the list of guys who have main evented a stadium show is pretty limited, and it's limited to people who, for the most part, are among the elite wrestlers of their generation, at least in terms of star power. But because WWE is hot and because people are really into Cody, and I suppose people are really excited to see Roman Reigns potentially come back, Solo is getting this SummerSlam match, but the remarkable thing to me about Solo is that, at least in my circles and what I see, we are in an era where, you know, every person that WWE pushes and gives a lot of TV time to seems to have a really loud vocal fan base for. Even someone like Dominic Mysterio, who I think is a totally useless wrestler who's very bad at almost everything, there are people out there that really love Dom and will tell you how great Dom is, and he gets such great heat and all this kind of stuff like that. And there's just, there's really, for anyone that WWE tries to give TV time and push, there are people there that'll be like, oh yeah, this guy's great. Except Solo. I don't know anyone that really argues that Solo Sikoa is a great wrestler, or even amongst the hardcore WWE fan base, that that Solo is good. I think he stands out amongst the bloodline as not particularly charismatic, not particularly good in the ring, not a compelling personality at all. And it really seems like he has almost nothing going for him. I think it was really telling when, you know, Jacob Fatu was brought in. And just immediately, you see WWE fans gravitate towards him because, you know, he looks impressive. He carries himself with a star level aura, and he does really cool shit in the ring that people like seeing. They like seeing him do moonsaults, like seeing him, you know, splash Cody through tables and things like that. And Fatu, you know, Jacob Fatu to me is, you know, a really classic presentation of a wrestling star in that sense. He's like a big guy that comes in, carries himself like a star, and does cool shit that gets over. And Solo just has none of that. And I think it's really telling that someone from the Performance Center that's kind of been groomed for this position for years and years to kind of take over from Roman when Roman is off on his, you know, numerous sabbaticals. And he doesn't have any promo skills. He doesn't have any aura. He doesn't have any charisma. All of these things that WWE likes to tell everyone that it does better than everyone else. And that's what they're teaching at the Performance Center. They're not just teaching people to wrestle. They're teaching them to become WWE superstars. And they're teaching them to look at the hard cam and understand how to project it, be a personality, and all this stuff that they love to talk about. And you have this guy, Sikoa, who's been groomed for this position, and he has absolutely none of those skills. And he's getting pushed to the moon, and he's getting a stadium show slot. And meanwhile, you have Jacob Fatu walking in, never spent any time in WWE, learned on the indies, learned in places outside of WWE, and he comes in and just immediately projects himself as a much bigger star. I mean, I think that's really telling when you compare the two between, you know, Fatu and Solo Sikoa. And I mean, I'm looking at, like, on Cage Match, even with all those WWE bot ratings, his rating in 2024 is just 5.36. And he's getting the biggest push of his life during that period. So he is just, and I think the main event of SummerSlam really is, it's not Cody versus Solo. It's Roman returning. You know, the focus of SummerSlam, or at least that particular match at SummerSlam, which I assume is going to be the main event, is at some point, Roman Reigns' music is going to hit, and he's going to run down to the ring, and he's going to do something. Maybe he's going to attack Cody. Maybe he's going to attack Solo. Maybe he's going to attack both of them. Who knows what he's going to do? But the entire appeal of the show is, what is Roman going to do? Which is a feather in Roman's cap in terms of his drawing power and the ability for him to captivate fan interest. But to me, it says, you know, it's nothing about the actual match. I don't think the fans really care who's going to win. I don't think they care about the world title. And I just think that's really stupid that the entire WWE's biggest match of the year, or the biggest match at SummerSlam, is built around, you know, an entrance pop. And I thought that the, you know, I'm starting to think that that WrestleMania Night 2 main event, the Cody versus Roman match, and the way that match was laid out, with, you know, The Rock coming out, and then John Cena comes out, and The Undertaker comes out, and it was essentially just like this Royal Rumble where, you know, guys' music hit, and the crowd pops and goes crazy, and then, you know, they run out and they hit a move, and then another person's music hits, and the crowd goes crazy again, and they run out and hit a move. That's what WWE fans want. They want to see entrance pops and big moves, and they want to see moments or chaos and things happening. And that seems to be what they're kind of teasing for the SummerSlam main event. It has almost nothing to do with Solo Sikoa. It has a little bit to do with Cody Rhodes in the sense that I think Cody is still the kind of compelling personality and babyface hero that the fans like. But it's largely about the promise of entrances and everyone act shocked that Roman showed up. And it just, it seems really stupid to me. I know I'm mostly preaching to the choir there, but it just, it's another sign, I think, of how different like WWE's interpretation of what pro wrestling is compared to mine and other people's, that like the, one of the biggest matches of the year is, has almost no juice for the, it's going to come across as a big match, but has almost no juice for the actual wrestlers in said match. It's about the promise of someone returning and a decision being made in terms of whose side Roman is going to be on or what he's even going to do. It'd be funny if Roman doesn't show up and like Cody just beats Solo in like a boring match, because there's no doubt the match is going to be boring. Like if Cody can get a 4-star match out of Solo Sikoa, that will be one of his most impressive in-ring achievements of his entire career. Because I think the match is going to be super boring and for a lot of parts probably pretty heatless. As fans wait for Roman's music to hit. The other WWE thing I want to talk about is, you know, Raw is headed to Netflix in a few months now. We're almost in August. So, you know, we've got 5 months left of Raw on USA, and then it's off to Netflix at the start of the new year. So I've been thinking about this a lot. There's been a lot of discussion about like streaming services not really being the fulcrum of television like some people think. A lot of the data coming out is showing that a lot of people aren't actually watching these streaming services that exist. Now, Netflix is kind of the exception to that. It's a really dominant player in the overall television marketplace. And getting, you know, putting Raw on Netflix is far, far superior than like putting Raw on Peacock or putting it on Paramount Plus or HBO Max or some other streaming network. But at the same time, I do wonder, it's kind of a risk in, are people going to watch WWE and pro wrestling on Netflix? Do people go to Netflix to watch live sports? And the answer is, we don't really have a ton of data to show that because they haven't done a lot of live sports. But even if we're showing, you know, people are popping on their Netflix on a Tuesday or Wednesday, are they going to be like, are they going to see Monday Night Raw on the carousel and say, I'm going to turn on some Monday Night Raw? Obviously, there's a huge amount of potential there for WWE to kind of, I think, maybe not necessarily create new fans, but really help gain back some lapsed fans or get some fans who watch on occasion to watch more regularly if they have access to it on Netflix, because a lot of people are just turning on that Netflix and seeing what's on. But I do have a lot of questions about whether, you know, WWE and Raw can be one of the things on Netflix that captures people's attention, that captures their interest. Or is it going to just be one of the other countless entertainment offerings that are on that platform that don't seem to really have a strong following or kind of just fall by the wayside? I think about a lot about like the Suits phenomenon. You know, Suits is, you know, the former, I'm sure most people are familiar with, at least with the former USA show Suits. It kind of had this weird renaissance on Netflix last year, where just tons and tons of people were watching it, and it was kind of this run-of-the-mill forgettable show that had a lot of episodes on USA that people were interested in. And the reason people were interested in watching Suits was not necessarily because of like this huge passion and interest in Suits, but it was a really good show to put on in the background while you're doing something else, whether that's while you're working, which is a huge deal with more people working from home, or you're just scrolling around on your phone. You don't want something that really requires that much of your attention to hold. And I think that's what you see a lot of when you see shows that are achieving success on streaming services. You're seeing shows that don't really require you to think a lot, shows that don't really necessarily force you to pay constant attention to them. They're formulaic. I think like Law and Order does really well on streaming services for that same reason, because everyone, once you're familiar with kind of the Law and Order television process, or Criminal Minds or similar shows like that, once you're kind of familiar with the kind of procedural process that those shows have, you can kind of drift in and out and still really understand the episodes. And there's a million of those episodes. Is Raw going to be like that? Is a pro wrestling show going to be like that? I mean, it's definitely a show with a lot of recap videos, and they definitely explain everything to you really thoroughly. So in some ways, it can be a show you can kind of drift in and out of. But is it going to be the kind of entertainment that the people who are serially watching these streaming services like Netflix are going to go for? I just don't know. And I think that's something that's going to be really fascinating, because a lot of ways it's going to determine how popular WWE remains going forward. There's an opportunity here for them to become incredibly more popular because of Netflix. But there's also an opportunity for them to lose popularity, because it could just be another thing on Netflix. I know Netflix is plunking down a ton of money. This is kind of an experiment for them. I'm sure they're going to push it super, super hard. But at the end of the day, are you going to be able to convince a lot of people to just start watching, you know, WWE Raw passively on Netflix, as opposed to that fan base that was tuning in every week on USA? I think it's a complete unknown at this point. And it is probably the biggest story of, I think, you know, pro wrestling in 2025 is going to be, you know, how many people are really invested in watching Raw each week on Netflix. I think that is something that maybe not talking about a ton yet, because we're still a few months away, but it's something that we got to keep a really close eye on, as fans. We're going to close it out. I've got two thoughts on AEW, stuff. So we'll start with this, Bryan Danielson versus Swerve main event at Wembley Stadium. I'm a week or two behind in terms of the take machine has already rolled out for how people feel about, you know, it not being Hangman Page versus Swerve at Wembley Stadium versus, as opposed to, now it's, you know, Danielson winning the Owen and getting that slot. And now we're telling kind of a different story with, Danielson trying to win, you know, the world title for the first time in AEW. And this is his last full year as a pro wrestler. Whatever that means. And this is the kind of story they're telling where Danielson's kind of on his last legs as an in-ring performer. He's been selling, you know, his various injuries. He's still kind of selling the neck injury from the Tiger Driver, which I actually like. There's been a lot of discussion about, you know, the storyline of, you know, Will is afraid to hit the Tiger Driver 91 ever since he hit it on Bryan Danielson, because he thinks, you know, he's going to really hurt somebody. And there's criticism for that because Bryan Danielson is not only is he back wrestling, but he won the Owen and he's now challenging for the world title. So there's this conflicting nature of, well, how, you know, serious can Will's, you know, fear of someone being injured from this move be, if Bryan Danielson, the guy who's allegedly, you know, really badly injured, is, you know, challenging for the world title. And that's totally true. And I understand those criticisms and I even agree with them to a large extent. But I do think kind of a subtle story behind it is how Bryan is still selling his neck injury. And he's done that consistently since he's come back, and he's done it consistently during the Owen, that his neck is really damaged. A lot of it is stemming from taking the Tiger Driver 91. And are we going to see some sort of confluence of the storylines where Danielson's body just finally breaks down and betrays him and he loses this match at Wembley? And it's kind of an echo from the damage he took from the Tiger Driver 91. In terms of this not being Hangman's match, I think personally I was pulling for Hangman Swerve at Wembley Stadium. I thought that Hangman cut some really excellent promos when he returned. I loved this character, the motivation that he had, what he was going for. I think there would have been nothing wrong with doing the story where Hangman comes back. He, you know, gets his revenge. He beats everyone in the Owen, you know, viciously, gets all this heat, and then he challenges Swerve at Wembley Stadium. I think that's a totally good storyline, well executed. Two wrestlers, two really homegrown wrestlers, right? We're not relying on, you know, someone who had a huge run in WWE, or had a huge run in New Japan Pro Wrestling to kind of main event your biggest show. It's going to be two kind of homegrown developed wrestlers, Swerve and Hangman, wrestling at Wembley Stadium for the title. I think that would have been really great. I'm not totally against the direction that they've gone in, which is clearly to you know, hold off on the big major Hangman versus Swerve match, do this other story with Bryan Danielson, which has a lot of potential to be compelling. And I think Danielson's been really good so far. I really liked the promo segment where you have Danielson talking about, you know, the doctor talking about his neck, you know, not really being 100%. And he's, you know, he's got to be, you know, cautious of that. And then Jeff Jarrett comes by. And I thought Jeff Jarrett was going to just say, you know, Brian, you know, you gotta stop. It's too much. You know, you don't want to end up like, you know, a broken old man. You gotta put your health first. Cause that's kind of what I thought he was going to say, just because it's like, oh, here's this cagey old veteran, Jeff Jarrett, here to give some advice to Bryan Danielson. And instead he went the complete opposite and was like, you gotta stop making excuses. If you're going to go for this title, you've got to go in all in. You can't be worried about your personal health or safety. And I thought that was like a really interesting point that Jeff Jarrett made. And I think adds some compelling drama to this match. Danielson's one of the best performers ever. I think he's going to get us to a really special place in this match between him versus Swerve. So I don't have a problem with that being the main event. I liked the idea of Hangman and Swerve. And when you delay it, there's always the risk that someone's going to lose momentum. Someone could get hurt. Someone could just not get as over. Maybe this Hangman thing is really hot now, but if you hold off for it for 3 months, there's no guarantee it's going to be hot again. I mean, you can book, you can plan, you can try to keep it hot, but sometimes you don't have that kind of as much control over it as some people think in terms of something remaining hot. Sometimes, you know, the fans just lose interest for various other reasons that you can't really foresee coming. And it's not as hot in a few months or even a year if you finally want to do it, if you do it then. So I think there's a risk that comes with not doing Swerve versus Hangman there. I think it's a risk to what could be an era-defining feud. But I'm not willing to just totally say that it was the wrong decision, because we gotta wait to see it play out and how it works out, because there's a lot of juice in Bryan Danielson versus Swerve and Bryan Danielson going for the title and Bryan doing this injury angle. And there is a lot of potential in Swerve, you know, or Hangman chasing after Swerve and not getting his shot at Swerve, and being denied his chance at Swerve in a variety of different ways. So you're really building anticipation for that big clash. So I guess I don't really have like a major hot take on that in terms of like feeling super duper strongly one way or the other. I think I see both sides of kind of the arguments that different people have made. But I do think that there's a risk that comes with delaying the Swerve Hangman match. I don't think it's an automatic great idea to keep them apart forever and ever, because I think that you really need to rely on really, really precise booking to keep up the momentum that Hangman has. Because when Hangman came back in this new heel Hangman, don't give a fuck Hangman character, I think this is the hottest he's ever been in terms of interest. And as compelling of a personality as he's ever been. And I don't know if that's going to be the case in a few months. Just don't. So that's the risk that comes with kind of holding off on this match. But let's hope for the best. Last thing I want to touch on, a small little thing, is Hologram. This Hologram character, debuting on AEW Collision 2 weeks ago. He had his second match the other night. And what I want to point out about Hologram is really interesting. So, you know, over the years, AEW has signed a lot of really exciting wrestlers. They have, you know, brought in a lot of luchadors, a lot of guys that can do cool stuff in the ring. And for the most part, they just kind of throw them out there. They put them in showcase matches. They kind of hope they get over. But they're just kind of guys on the roster for the most part. You know, whether it's Commander, whether it's, you know, AR Fox, whether it's these different guys you kind of bring in, the top flight guys, you just kind of put them out there and you give them something. The Hologram character is very different. And I think in a lot of ways, a positive step towards AEW's kind of creative process in terms of, they gave him some vignettes. They hyped him up. They gave him, you know, an entrance and an outfit and a new name. Now, I personally think the hologram name and the outfit and the lights, they come across as hokey. I don't think they're particularly cool. It's not what I would have done with the wrestler, but it shows a real effort and attempt. And we're gonna really try something with this new guy, as opposed to just taking, a guy that can do cool moves and throwing him in a few matches and hoping he gets over by doing some flips. But they bring him out there, they hype him up, and he goes out there and his first match is against Gringo Loco. His second match is against, the Beast Mortos or Black Taurus, whatever you want to call him. And so what do those two guys have in common, Gringo Loco and the Beast Mortis? They're regarded as two of the best bases in the entire world. They're perfect for debuting someone like Hologram, who is, Aramis, former, indie wrestler and wrestled in AAA and a lot of the a lot of US indies in recent years, but also a lot of independents in Mexico. But really, interesting worker, really, even by lucha standards, there's a lot of unique, cool stuff, moves around the ring in a really cool way. Very cool wrestler, a good guy to do this with, right? You bring in this guy, hype him up, make him seem like he's going to be totally different than everyone else. And while you have a lot of guys that can do flips and guys that do high spots and stuff like that, he is different than those other guys, which I think is important. But you're seeing a real concerted effort to push this guy as a unique entity and not just another guy on the roster. And I don't know if it's going to work necessarily. I don't know if it's going to be something that, he's going to end up being a world champion one day or anything like that. But I like the creative effort that's gone into presenting him, which is, we're going to have him, we're going to hype him up with some vignettes. We're going to have him have this different entrance. We're going to have the announcers talk about him. He's going to go out there and have these showcase matches. We're going to make sure we get the absolute best guys for him to be in the ring with, which are the two guys he's wrestled so far, Gringo Loco, and Black Taurus, as just two guys that can do all of the stuff for him, that make him look like a million bucks, make him look like this cool and unique figure. And so far, so good. I think, we've had the two kind of collision tapings in Arlington, Texas, and I think the vibes are there. I think the crowd sounds into him. He came out for his second match, and I think the crowd recognized him and was into him. And obviously, he did a bunch of cool shit. But I'm really interested in seeing kind of how he develops, because we're seeing a really concerted effort in introducing this guy. And it's what WWE would do. And I mean that, I usually say that in a negative way, but I mean this in a positive way, which is really making you care, or trying to get fans to care about this individual as an entity, as opposed to just being another guy on the roster. And I think it's smart, and I think it's good progression for AEW introducing new wrestlers, because they got a ton of guys with, young guys with talents, but it's kind of hard for those guys to always stand out. And I think they're on the right track with Hologram, even if the gimmick is dopey. I think he's there. So those are my six topics. I got through them all in about an hour and 10 minutes, which sounds about right. I thank everyone who's been listening to the show, and I'll be back with a guest probably in a couple of weeks. But thanks a lot. I'll talk to everyone again after a while. Take care.
Hey now, it's Mike Gilbert, host of the Mike and JD Show, right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Join JD by God Oliva and myself every Thursday night live on the Voices of Wrestling YouTube channel at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, as we stay up all night discussing all the hottest stories in professional wrestling. You can also check us out right here on the Voices of Wrestling podcasting feed, or you can subscribe to the Mike and JD Show feed. Now, enjoy the show.